Evening, everyone. Thanks for your being here. Appreciate, as always, the enormous encouragement there is in sharing this like precious faith, encouraging one another, especially in these Sunday evenings. We've been studying, starting last week, will be for several weeks to come, life and events in Joseph, the famous Joseph of the Old Testament, not of the New. But the Joseph whose life was just exceptionally difficult and lonely, lacking for much of his life the camaraderie, the fellowship, you know, the support group that we have as members of the Lord's church. So thank you one and all for being who you are. I'm going to start a little bit unusually this evening, but I hope that you'll see, you know, the contact for it in the life of Joseph in just a minute. So if you'll bear with me, I'd like to point out first this admonition from Solomon as he opens up this marvelous book of Proverbs, this book of wisdom, this book of practical application. He says, "Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching." So from the eighth verse of the book of Proverbs, he's saying, look to your parents, look to their example, listen to their experiences. Do not make the mistake of thinking that you know better, that you can see the flaws in their thinking and all of that. They're older than you are, they've been through all this and you haven't. And so listen to the father's instruction. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Now, probably you would have heard me say this before, but I'm going to rehearse a little bit longer. That's the unusual part here this evening. I have been saying now for very many years that I have been blessed with three fathers. I think of three men who have had just profound influence over my life. And so more than just Solomon's admonition from those who biologically have been a part of your family, I think we can learn from others as if they were parents and by means of the examples that they set. And so I am the son of Ed Haverstock, now deceased some 6 years. A man who never came to Christ, a profane man, a man who was a smoker and a drinker, quit the cigarettes, you know, fairly early in his life. Last few years when the doctor said either quit or die, he then quit, you know, with the drinking. But he was not a staggering drunk. He was nothing of the kind, but he was a heavy drinker. He was a constant drinker, what they call a maintenance drinker. But he was a man of integrity. He was a child of the Depression. He was a man who taught me about manhood when I was young. So all those basic lessons, work hard, be honest, you know, those kinds of things that he taught me. And I was greatly blessed. It was the providential hand of God that gave me a man who, while he had no spiritual side whatsoever, was nonetheless a man of character insofar as the world goes. And we all need, you know, to grow up and to live in the world. So I have nothing but the greatest, you know, fondness and appreciation for this man. I certainly do wish that he had come to Christ, which he never did. But the foundation he built under me in the realm of character in the material world is just absolutely invaluable to me. And I've told him so before he died personally, you know, in letter. You know, I expressed that to him. I've had a second father, who I think of as my spiritual father, if you will, in Lowell Williams. Some of you at least know the name, remember Lowell. He's left this earth now, not quite 2 years ago, I believe, that it is. But I came to Washington, began to study with Lowell for just a couple of months before Don and I were married. After our wedding in December of 1975, we moved to the Kirkland congregation and crossed the border into Washington there, you know, January 1st of 1976. And I've sometimes thought, you know, if my wife didn't have second thoughts about this guy she married, because I had come to Washington for the express purpose of studying my Bible under this man whose reputation had reached to Colorado's, where I first learned about him. So immediately, instantly, in fact, I'd already started in the preceding months. Now, what Donna discovered when we married is that we would go together on a Sunday morning to Kirkland, where there was a Bible class, which, of course, we were part of. I listened to Lowell preach again, as in, you know, we have our typical morning worship, the third time in the evening, three times on Sunday. And then I would go back after a full day at work in the construction trades. We would come home, grab a bite to eat, and I would be off to Kirkland again. Because Lowell on Monday nights also taught two Bible classes. And so those classes lasted a minimum of 60 minutes, often 90 minutes, typically would end somewhere between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, and I would come home to my bride. So Sunday, three lessons, Monday, two lessons. And then I went back for two more lessons on Tuesday evening. And then I went back for two more lessons on Wednesday evening. And then I went back for two more lessons on Thursday evening. So for the first several years that we were married, I was studying my Bible 11 classes a week over the course of 5 days a week, working full time, as was my wife at the time. That went on, you know, for years, eventually just shy of 5 years, that we then left that congregation, my first intensive, you know, training in Bible study, and spent 27 years preaching up in northern Washington. I then, in 1986, decided that this man's teaching, his fundamental understanding of doctrine, of Scripture, was so profoundly advanced and instructive and important that then we'd moved, but I started driving on, what was it? It was Tuesday evenings, I guess, Tuesday afternoons. I would drive 40 miles now down to film two of his classes, spend the night at a deacon's house so I could record the Wednesday morning ladies' Bible class, and the rest of that day so I could film two more classes in the evening. So for years then, I was studying under Lowell, seven more years, as much as five classes a week, and I wasn't even home overnight. And again, I guess Donna might have had some wonderments about all of that. But Lowell was my spiritual mentor. He was the one who gave me my doctrinal understandings, you know, the highest lessons, you know, in my early life at least. He taught me to study endlessly. He taught me to seek the truth. He made a Bible student out of me. That's a different kind of a father then. The third father, I'm sure none of you will know, what I think of as my practical father, was a man by the name of Wendell Smith. He is yet living. I have high hopes. I hope to be able to see him again before he passes. But he's deep into his 80s now and becoming much more, you know, infirm. But still, I hope, you know, at least I can have some more contact with him. Because for a period of about 4.5 years, he hired me to work in his construction business. So 5 days a week, first thing in the morning, I'd go to his house. He would assign responsibilities. But what I saw in him was how to be a Christian in the physical world. My first father, he couldn't teach me that. But Wendell did. He was a deacon in the congregation there at Kirkland. And the things that he suffered as a businessman, you know, building residential custom homes for the nearly 5 years that I was with him, were just invaluable lessons. He's the most honest man you ever met, the most dedicated servant of God that you can imagine, just as pure as anything that you can conceive. And yet, I know that he was so mistreated by his customers. There were 44 houses that we built together in those years. And in those 44 homes, we met with 44 families. And that man actually, honest, kind and compassionate, nothing more than desiring to do the best that he could for his customers, was once driven off the property of the home that he had built by an angry woman flinging both curses and gravel at him. Gravel weed brought in and spread on that property. She bent down and picked up and hurled at him and drove him off the property. And I can tell you, I can testify like few people can, he had done no wrong. The one and only time I've had to sit in a court and testify was because another family, Baptists in this case, the wife very proud of being, you know, a Baptist Sunday school teacher, was one of the most evil liars I ever met. I once hid in a closet to avoid that woman when she came on the property. And while I was hiding in that closet, I heard her come in showing a friend around the house, pointed at a light fixture, big, gaudy chandelier that I'd brought to that place from a local lighting company, and I heard her from the bowels of a closet declare that it had been imported from Czechoslovakia, and there was none other in the world, and vastly expensive. And it was, to me, just gaudy junk. Then they sued us. Wouldn't pay for the house that we had built. Wound up in court. And I watched that man show me how to set God first, no matter what anybody is doing to you, and how to teach your children while you're in that process. Because I worked with his three sons. We put siding up together. And I think the oldest was 12 when I first became a part, you know, honorary part of the family. And so we worked together. All those boys are still faithful to this day, committed to their God. That was an amazing family. And so I had these three examples that have shaped my life. A man who taught me, as even an atheist could, not that he was an atheist, but, you know, there are lots of good parents who have nothing to do with God. They just can teach a physical side, but not the spiritual. Then I had a man who could lead me into very advanced studies. I got 3 out of my 5 years of Greek studies from Lowell Williams. And then, you know, in practical application, Wendell Smith showed me how to do it. This leads me to a famous quote from Mark Twain. He said, "God, the most popular scapegoat for our sins." I would only change that to read, "the most popular scapegoat for everything." What I'm trying to do is to show the intersection now between behaving properly and then not having things go well. Having been trained, you know, to behave in such a manner, even when they're throwing rocks at you and hauling you into court. God is everybody's most popular point to finger at and blame victim. This is just the way that most people do, as if they played no role in the circumstances that they got themselves into. In Job, the first couple of chapters, of course, you'll know quite well, is my personal favorite of Job's sufferings, and I've not yet been able to identify who this artist was, so it does look like it can be a couple of hundred years old even. But this is Job chapter 2 and verse 9, as you see here, this wife of Job's, after so much suffering, saying to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Can you imagine? A wife as supportive as that. She wanted to play that blame game. She wanted to lay this at the feet of God as if it were inexcusable. Utterly unbeknownst to her at the time, and as well utterly unbeknownst to Job himself, God was responsible from the standpoint at some, you know, time later. I don't know if he ever quite figured it out, you know, but we learn in the book that this man was the ultimate test case. One of the first sermons I ever preached was entitled, "Would God Have Chosen You?" And he was one of my examples. Could you have gone through this so that God could have his conversation in heaven with Satan himself? "My people will serve me because it is right to serve me, regardless of whether all things go well for them in this life. And I can prove it, Satan. I will permit you to misuse this man, to abuse this man, to torment and torture this man, to steal from him all of the most precious things that you can imagine in this life. And you watch and see if he will not continue to praise and serve me." As a matter of fact, we'd already been told before the wife got into his face in chapter 1 of verse 22, through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Awesome. Awesome to imagine. That in his blindness and ignorance, because God hasn't informed him yet, he will lose all of his children, all of his possessions, his health, and even the faithfulness of his wife toward her God. He would lose all these things, but he wouldn't sin. and he would not blame God. All of this is just to demonstrate that when you're looking for examples in life, somebody that can show you that it can be done, this task of serving God in a world that chooses anything else. This man, Joseph, thrown into the pit, sold into slavery, this man is one of those that we, all of us, could pick out as a sort of a spiritual father, if you will, as an example, a testament, one, you know, that we can emulate on how to take these things and make them all work in your life today. God, Satan, the world, the physical, you know, stresses and strains and demands that life places upon us, but ultimately still being able to love our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, with all of our strength, our neighbor as ourselves, and serve Him absolutely faithfully. What must Joseph have been thinking when he was hated by his brothers because his father loved him? When he was hated by the whole family because God had turned him into a prophet? When he was sold into slavery, first in the pit and then watching them, you know, get the money and hauled off, you know, in chains. He lost his family. He lost his home. He lost his country. He was driven out, you know, and into Egypt, where he would be falsely accused as a slave and finally be imprisoned. You know, I suppose, brethren, once or twice he must have wondered, whose fault is this? What in the world could I have done to deserve anything like this? Is it God's fault? This is, as Mark Twain knew so well, everybody's favorite answer. In most cases, their first answer, and in many cases, their only answer. And in their ignorance and blindness, can't see any farther beyond that answer. You know, it has to be God's fault. Well, I've been highly blessed to have those three men show me how to do it. Some people don't get those examples in this life, and they have to overcome the parents so that they can learn these lessons on their own or from somebody else. And yet, even if that's the case in your life, what is Joseph telling you? Can you still do right and good and be successful in life, even if your family hates you, siblings and parents? Even if you know you're the innocent victim of terrible things, can you still do it? Is it God's fault? Well, this brings us back to Job again. In Job chapter 1 and verses 20 through 22, it says, after he had learned of the death of all of his children, the loss of all of his possessions, Job arose and tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and what? Worshipped. He didn't bemoan God's failure. He didn't suggest that God had neglected him. He didn't turn his back on God. Well, if this is the way it's going to be, then forget you. It was none of these things. In the worst of his suffering, he falls to the ground and he worships his God in the midst of this loss. In verse 21, he said, naked I came from my mother's womb. That's not possessing a whole lot. And naked I shall return. Everybody does. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Awesome. Amazing. To think, deprived of all things, that this man would never deprive himself of his God, of his love for his God. And so it is in verse 22 through all this. So we saw just that last line a moment ago. He did not sin. He did not blame God. He could find nothing that he would, no charge he could lay at the feet of God in heaven though his suffering is this bad. Now, a moment ago, Carl was reading for us, reciting for us, Psalm 105, verses 17 through 22. I'd like to put them up on the screen for you again. It's rather interesting. This happens a number of times in Scripture where, for instance, in this case, you read through Genesis and you see everything that we're told about Job. Genesis, Moses, think 1,500 years before Christ. Psalms, think David, 500 years later. And 500 years later, we learn things in this inspired psalm that are not told us in the book of Genesis. In Psalm 105 and verse 17, he sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. Well, we got that much in Genesis. They afflicted his feet with fetters. He himself was laid in irons. I didn't know that. You scan through, well, when did that happen? Did his brothers do it when they threw him in the pit? The Midianites do it when they haul him off to be sold? Did the slave master do it? Did it happen in the jail? And there's no talk about his feet being in these fetters, about his being laid in irons. And so in Joseph's case, there are details about the degree of his suffering that is approaching the lengthy description of Job's suffering that we don't even learn for 500 years until the Psalms explain it to us. But they afflicted him with these fetters. He was laid in these irons until the time his word, that's God's word, came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. Far be it for most people to think while they're pointing their fingers at the heavens and blaming God for having failed them that they would be suffering the way they are. For it would never enter their minds that this is God finding out what I'm made out of. This is God searching the depths of my heart and mind and faith to see who I am, what my character is, how much I understand about this world, the Scriptures, and how to put those two together. Until the time his word came to pass, the word of the Lord was testing Joseph. And again, when you read Genesis, you don't see that. You get the bare bones statement that this is what happened. Well, okay. And it doesn't appear that anybody's telling Joseph the reason why any more than they're telling Job the reason why. But the reason is, we learn, that God was testing the man. Think also in terms then of preparing the man. God is working with Joseph. Something's coming down the road. Something fabulous. Something astonishing. Something indescribably precious and important. You know the end of the story, of course. The salvation of an entire nation. The preservation of the Jewish lineage that would bring us the Messiah who would save the entire world. But while that plan is being worked, the instrument for the success of God's plan is himself being put through a wringer so that God will know. Now, brethren, I think you'll learn in other places, and we'll take the time to get into it tonight. But it's not like God is surprised, of course. When it says this, it's also suggesting so that he would know who he was, what he was, so that he was perfected in his self, in his personality and character, and fit then for the purpose. He had been tried and not found wanting, but had been found full and complete and therefore ready to be this magnificent servant in the service of God. So in verse 20 it says, the king sent and released him, the ruler of the peoples, and set him free. He made him lord of his house and ruler over all his possessions. Two, now here's another job description that you don't see in Genesis, but here in Psalm 105, here's Joseph's power. Last verse, 22, to imprison his princes, Pharaoh's princes, at will, that he might teach his elders wisdom.
whoa, I didn't see that in Genesis. I didn't see that coming. Think of the depths and the facets of God's plan for this man, Joseph. Wow, he's going through all these things, being tested for all these by all these things, and prepared for all these things. Eventually, he who had been imprisoned would find what? He holds the jailer's keys at will. He who had started off as a 17-year-old prophet and was sold into slavery for it is going to teach his elders wisdom. That is, in Egypt, this young man, only 30 when he comes, you know, to this place, vice pharaoh over all of Egypt, you know, is going to show some people what wisdom is. What it is to know, to understand, to have insight, to see what others simply cannot see. About this time you start asking yourself, would it have been worth it? Would God have chosen me? Could I have passed the test and thus have acquired this wisdom myself to learn before I'm 31 years old how to rule a superpower nation and play a role that when he enters into that position, he still cannot conceive will result in the salvation of his nation. In Proverbs chapter 24, just the single verse 10, it says this. If you are slack in the day of distress, slack in the day of distress. Now we'll just stop there. Think about the first half of this. If I'm slack in the day of distress, the picture then is trouble has come upon you. As a matter of fact, Job will also tell us that man is born for trouble like what? Told you this a few weeks ago. Man is born for trouble like sparks fly upward. That's how sure it is. What do sparks do? They fly upward. And you're born for that. But when it comes, if you're slack, you know, the idea is you're not squaring up for the battle. You don't have a plan and you know exactly what you're going to do. When you go slack, you just... It's a picture of confusion. It's a picture of indecision. It's a picture that is anything but favorable. And so, let's fill in the blank here. If you're slack in the day of distress, then blame God. You know, lament your lot. How it is you don't deserve it. Why me? All of that, right? Where most people would go. And sore is the temptation. No, it says your strength is limited. If you're slack in the day of distress, all it says is, it's your fault. Deal with it. You're just weak. That's what that is. And there is who to blame? Anybody else but yourself. If you've spent your lifetime preparing for the day of distress, then when you see it coming, brethren, you lean in. Give it your best shot. I shall not be moved. We sing that song. One of my favorite pictures, you know, images in the Lord of the Rings comes from two towers. Remember when the Ents are standing there, the dam is broken and the flood comes, and you watch some of those Ents and what they do? And you just see their toes grabbing the dirt and just lean into it. Let that tidal wave come. So, brethren, that's the way we're supposed to be. Every last one of us. We're not just blowing in the wind, doctrinally or physically in the material world. We're supposed to be giants who understand everything there is to know about this life. So nothing surprises us. I've had Moses telling me about it. I got all of the patriarchs in Genesis that Moses wrote about telling me about it. As we saw this morning, I got Joshua showing me how. I got Samuel telling me about it. I got Jeremiah. We saw quotes this morning from every one of them. These are all people who face their tragedies, their trials, the terrible, you know, setbacks in life. Be sure you read the Bolton article this morning. What do you do when your brethren fail you? It can really set you back. Or it can really charge you up. Dig in and get some good work done. If you're slack in the day of distress, then shame on you. That you weren't ready. That you hadn't learned. That you were weak. And you just stand there like that 65-pound weakling, just all slack, haven't got a muscle, you know, in your spiritual bodies, haven't got a clue what to do. This was not Joseph. He started out his life as the favored son, and for good reason. We'd seen his character last week. This was a boy who just wanted to do all things right. God blessed him with the gift of prophecy. And look where he got him. Well, it got him right to the top. But first, brethren, he had to slog through that swamp, didn't he? He had to experience all the awfulness that the world could offer. But like Job before him, he never blamed God. He just simply formed muscle, bone, and the gristle to go get the job done without complaint, without recriminations against God. Do the job. It's what you were called to. So get up and take care of your job instead of just being a weakling who flounders around wondering what it's supposed to do, maybe looking for somebody else to do it for them. I'm going to close the lesson this evening with Genesis chapter 50. It's the last chapter in the book of Genesis. It's the last that we learn about the life of this astonishing man, now come to the end of his days, now having been reunited with his brethren, forgiven them and caring for them. You know the story. We haven't read it, but you're very familiar with it. Genesis 50 and verse 20, though, he has this wondrous insight that he offers to those now repentant and ashamed brothers who'd sold him so many years ago into slavery. He says in verse 20, "You meant evil against me." They sure did. In fact, had it not been for Reuben's argument, what would have happened in that pit? They'd have killed him. It was murder that the other brothers had on their minds. "Now let's sell him," was a ruse to save his life. Reuben was ashamed and, you know, just collapsed with lamentation when he realized the other brothers had sold Joseph into slavery. But he said, you did. You meant evil against me. That was your thought. That was your intent. That was your conscious purpose. But God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, which took quite a few years to get to preserve many people alive. Recently, we studied in a single night the entire book of Esther. God will save these people, Esther, whether it's you or somebody else. But who knows whether or not what? It's your turn. It's your time. You're ready, Esther. Stand up. Show the world what a backbone is. It's your time. And she did. Showed the world what it was all about. Risked her life. And would do all those many centuries later the very same thing that Joseph had done so long ago. Preserve many people alive. Verse 21, it says, "So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. This is a man who knew how to forgive. This is a man who knew how you grow up, you get over, and then, you know, you resolve the problem. So I'll leave you with these thoughts from the life of Joseph here this evening. Who was Joseph? Just a kid like you once were. Who was Joseph? A guy with the whole world like a stacked deck against him. Who was Joseph? Helpless, abused, captive, kidnapped. Who was Joseph? Child of God. Growing, learning, the same lessons Job learned, the same lessons Esther learned, and the same lessons, brethren, we must each and every one of us also learn. Who knows what will happen in your life tomorrow? We have urgent prayer requests, one after the other, that came to us you know, in this last week. The moment has come for them. It's likely to come for you because you know what you were born for? Trouble. Like sparks fly upward. It's coming, brethren. You either choose to be prepared and like Tolkien's Ents, you can lean into it and just leave a wake behind, or you can go slack, be ashamed, fail. Hopefully if you do that, at least you'll rise up and start over, learn from the failure, and try again. But why go through failure? Why not just do it like Job? Joseph, all the rest, the great heroes, Esther, chief among them. This we can do. This we were also born to do. This we must do. Till if it be so, brethren, you're the last Christian standing in Eugene, Oregon. 10 years from now, they've all died off or moved away. And the whole of the city is converted to atheism. And you're the only person in this building on a Sunday morning. Then what? Be the best Christian in Eugene, Oregon. The state, the country, or the world. When you get to be as alone as Joseph was for so much of his life, you can still be a towering monument to God and to Christian strength and power and indomitability. We cannot be conquered. Romans says so. Appreciate your attention as always. Hope then, brethren, as you face this next week, you'll lean on in. This we can do. Sure we can. See you again on Wednesday night now, won't I? I'm looking forward to it. In the meantime, if we can be of help to you somehow, then obviously you know that we offer this opportunity for you to come speak with me, talk to one of the elders if you wish. But we're here to help if we can. I had three fathers who taught me how to do it. I'm trying to be of a similar nature myself. Let us help if you need it as we stand and sing.